Autoimmune bullous diseases are a group of acquired disorders characterized by antibodies against antigenic targets that are essential for the structural integrity of the skin. In this dialogue, Dr. Rhonda Klein and Dr. Whitney High discuss the latest laboratory techniques used to assess and diagnose immunobullous diseases, as well as the sensitivity and specificity of these tests.
This is Dr. Rhonda Klein interviewing Dr. Whitney High from the University of Colorado today on an update on immunobullous conditions. Welcome, Dr. High. Today we're going to talk a little bit about different laboratory techniques to assess and diagnose immunobullous conditions, as well as sensitivity and specificity of these techniques and problems that we often encounter in practice to identify these conditions. So why don't we start first talking about some of the different techniques used to make these diagnosis of the different immunobullous conditions?
Sure. So I'm a dermatologist and a dermatopathologist, and I spend a significant amount of my time doing dermatopathology. And we also run an immunofluorescence lab in association with our dermatopathology lab. So I spend a lot of my day thinking about these diseases and working on these testing technologies such that we can provide quality information to our clients.
So when and in which conditions do you find it most helpful to just do a standard H&E biopsy versus direct immunofluorescence? When do you need indirect immunofluorescence for diagnosis? I guess we could start with bullous pemphigoid versus some other conditions. That's one of the most common immunobullous conditions we're encountering in clinic.
Sure. It's been estimated in several studies that bullous pemphigoid is up threefold in the last decade, and that probably has to do with people living longer, and we all know who typically gets bullous pemphigoid. So bullous pemphigoid is probably the main autoimmune disease that we encounter in my practice in at the University of Colorado's Dermatopathology Laboratory. So that's definitely worthwhile talking about. And the other ancillary techniques are probably worth bringing in too: direct immunofluorescence, indirect immunofluorescence, serology testing. And bullous pemphigoid is certainly where we spend the wheelhouse, the majority of our time covering bullous pemphigoid. And so I think that bullous pemphigoid is often a diagnosis that begins with clinical suspicion, and then an H&E that's supportive of the diagnosis. But it's very rare that we can just look at an H&E and say that's bullous pemphigoid and that's nothing else, particularly when you have urticarial bullous pemphigoid that can present kind of as just a non-specific spongiotic perivascular dermatitis with a few eosinophils here and there in the superficial dermis. And so I think that's where you bring in your other ancillary techniques like direct immunofluorescence and indirect immunofluorescence and ELISA measurements.
Can you remind our audience the H&E findings for bullous pemphigoid and some of the other conditions that can mimic bullous pemphigoid or should or that remain in your differential diagnosis after you have a specimen that's consistent with bullous pemphigoid on H&E?
Sure. So bullous pemphigoid, you know, classically presents in an older patient with a lot of comorbidities as these tense bulla, often in intertriginous areas. And the patients that I've had as a dermatologist often begins in the feet, the toe webs, the axillary area. And we kind of know what classic bullous pemphigoid looks like clinically and the historical and demographic information that would accompany that diagnosis. But more and more, we see unusual presentations of bullous pemphigoid where they have urticarial phase bullous pemphigoid. And that can look kind of nonspecific. I mean, if it's urticarial phase bullous pemphigoid, it can look kind of just like sheets of red erythematous skin. And so that becomes more problematic from a diagnostic standpoint. What we usually see under the microscope in a classic bullous pemphigoid, you see the subepidermal vesiculation, you see a lot of eosinophils, particularly some eosinophilic spongiosis. The eosinophils are generally confined to the upper aspects of the dermis, which is different from insect bite or arthropod bite reaction or something like that. You're not looking for eosinophils down at the subcuticular junction or anything like that. You're looking for shallow eosinophils. And that's what you see in classic bullous pemphigoid. More and more we see situations where we think from the historical information that bullous pemphigoid might be within the differential diagnosis. They're an older patient, they have maybe protracted pruritus, things of that nature. And then we only see really a perivascular dermatitis with shallow eosinophils. And sometimes I've had to say in my comment section, you know, it seems your clinical data is compelling for bullous pemphigoid. Is that within the clinical differential? And if so, then I would suggest proceeding with direct immunofluorescence studies or something of that nature.
Definitely. And there's certainly some other conditions that remain in our differential when we see that on H&E, such as epidermal bullosa acquisita, or if you have a neutrophil-rich bullous pemphigoid, a linear IgA. So then we move on to direct immunofluorescence. And how is that helpful to us in differentiating some of these conditions?
Yeah, so in classic bullous pemphigoid, all those entities you said would be in the differential diagnosis, even by light microscopy as well, those entities would be in the clinical differential. But in urticarial phase bullous pemphigoid, it might just be, you know, drug-induced process, because many of these patients are older, on a lot of medications, polypharmacy. And so that's in the differential diagnosis. But when you move on to direct immunofluorescence, which is probably the best single study you could do in terms of sensitivity for bullous pemphigoid, what you're looking for is you're looking for linear deposition of IgG and C3 at the dermal epidermal junction as a band. And it's true that you can see deposition of other immunoreactants as well, but generally what you're looking for is IgG and C3. That's the real key to the diagnosis. But more importantly, with direct immunofluorescence, as dermatopathologists, we often sign those out as consistent with bullous pemphigoid. And what we're saying is that there's linear deposition of IgG and C3, and this would be consistent with bullous pemphigoid, particularly given that you suspect the patient does have bullous pemphigoid. But that's really, really important for everybody to keep in mind, that it's consistent with, meaning that there are other entities, even by immunofluorescence, that could mimic bullous pemphigoid, like epidermolysis bullosa acquisita, bullous lupus erythematosus, cicatricial pemphigoid. All those things might mimic by direct immunofluorescence bullous pemphigoid, but we're just telling you, since that entity's the most common, bullous pemphigoid being the most common immunobullous condition, and you suspected bullous pemphigoid, that's a reasonable diagnosis at this juncture, but it does take some clinical acumen to decide if that's your final diagnosis.
Exactly. So if we moved on to indirect immunofluorescence to tease apart some of those latter entities that you mentioned, can you discuss a little bit about collecting a sample for indirect immunofluorescence and then what the indirect immunofluorescence can show us?
Sure. So the major difference between direct immunofluorescence is in direct immunofluorescence, you're using the patient's tissue and your materials to generate that result. So you're looking at the patient tissue under the immunofluorescent microscope, and you're looking for the deposition of immune reactants. In an indirect immunofluorescence, what you're taking is the patient's sera and your tissue, and you're basically repeating the same step and looking for deposition of their antibodies on your substrate. That's really the difference between direct and indirect immunofluorescence. Now, direct immunofluorescence probably has upwards of 90% sensitivity for bullous pemphigoid, whereas indirect has lesser sensitivity than does direct immunofluorescence, but it allows you to do other things to the tissue, which I believe we'll cover in a minute, like salt split skin, things like that, where you can get to a more refined diagnosis, even if it doesn't have the same sensitivity. And then now gaining ground with both bullous pemphigoid and with pemphigus, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, is ELISA studies. And ELISA studies are just direct measurements of antibodies in the patient's sera, and you can actually use those titers to track treatment and improvement of the disease.
Great. Thank you for mentioning all those entities. In terms of direct immunofluorescence and indirect immunofluorescence, collecting the samples for our patients, mm-hmm. for direct immunofluorescence, are most practitioners still using Michelle's medium? Or are they just doing fresh frozen samples? What are they sending to
the lab
for you?
That's a great question and good background information for all dermatologists to know, because I get a substantial number of phone calls during my day about, well, what should I do? Where should I take the specimen? How should I send it to you? So let's just cover that. That's great setup for what we're going to talk about next. So in direct immunofluorescence, well, let's just take a typical bullous pemphigoid patient. What I do for a bullous pemphigoid patient when I'm seeing them as a dermatologist, and I'm also a dermatopathologist, is I will shave off the entire bulla. That to me is the sine qua non for making the diagnosis. I shave off the entire bulla in a deep tangential shave. I shave the entire blister off. That allows me to look at the entirety of the process, look for the eosinophils, look for the subepidermal vesiculation, and I'm not encumbered by the fact that if I take a punch biopsy, what if the epidermis peels off and floats away, and now I only have the dermis to look at, things like that. Then I will move away from the blister, maybe 5 millimeters to 10 millimeters, and I'll do a punch biopsy for my direct immunofluorescence. And so once I have that punch biopsy for direct immunofluorescence, the question comes, how do I send it to the laboratory? And this is what I get phone calls about in my practice. There's several different ways to do it. And in fact, they've looked at this. The single thing you don't want to do is put it in formalin, because there is an excellent 2011 study where they looked at the loss of information in direct immunofluorescence when a substrate was placed momentarily in formalin. So in 2 minutes or less than 2 minutes, the diagnostic utility of direct immunofluorescence for pemphigus was destroyed by placing the substrate in formalin. In 10 minutes, it was ruined for dermatitis pediformis and bullous pemphigoid. So you want to avoid the tendency of your medical assistants and things to just immediately put it into formalin and then think, oh my gosh, I just put it in formalin, I'm going to pull it back out. So it's just a very short while of time in formalin that can destroy a direct hemophoresis specimen. The ways to do it better are to put it in Michelle's media, as you mentioned, and that's perfectly fine. We ship out tons of Michelle's media from my facility to our clients just for that sole purpose. But you can also just put it in normal saline. And there was a very elegant study a few years ago where they actually looked at normal saline versus Michelle's media, and they found that actually normal saline was superior in most circumstances as long as the specimen was going to be processed in 24 to 48 hours. If you start going beyond 48 hours, then Michelle's media starts to become an improvement in terms of preserving the utility of the test. But normal saline is just fine. So when we encounter a laboratory or a client office that doesn't have Michelle's media on hand, maybe they've run out, maybe they do so few skin biopsies that they don't keep any on hand, it's important to remember that they can just place it in normal, just a few drops of normal saline on the specimen in a clean urine container, something like that, and off it goes to the laboratory. So perilesional skin placed in either normal saline for a short while or in Michelle's media if you're intending for a longer duration, longer transport time, is perfect for a direct hemophoresis.
That's very helpful because we often have that debate in our practice. So moving on to pemphigus for a moment, similar, obviously, biopsy techniques where you want your standard H&E of the full lesion and then your perilesional skin for the direct immunofluorescence. Can you speak a moment about some of the ELISA tests that can be helpful for differentiating pemphigus vulgaris versus pemphigus foliaceus, monitoring the titers for clinical response?
Sure. So often we get DIF specimens, direct immunofluorescence specimens for pemphigus. And of course, in pemphigoid, you're looking for subepidermal vesiculation and linear deposition of immunoreactants during direct immunofluorescence. In pemphigus, you're looking for loose, fragile blisters because it's an intraepidermal process. And then you're looking for deposition of, again, IgG and C3 principally in the epidermis in kind of a fishnet-like pattern. And so that's what we're looking for under the microscope because, again, the antibodies that are active in pemphigus are desmoglein 1 and desmoglein 3, and they're completely different from bolus pemphigoid antigen 1 and bolus pemphigoid antigen 2 and bolus pemphigoid. And so you're looking for an intraepidermal process. Sometimes, and I look at direct immunofluorescence every single week under the microscope, sometimes you can tell that there's more deposition in the bottom of the epidermis, like pemphigus vulgaris, or more deposition in the top of the epidermis, like pemphigus foliaceus. But it's really kind of a soft finding. You don't want to hang the entire diagnosis based on your pattern of deposition under the microscope. Under direct immunofluorescence. It's also possible to measure by ELISA the desmoglein 1 and desmoglein 3 antibodies, and we do that a lot simply because the titers do correlate with disease activity. And that's the same thing's true in bullous pemphigoid. The titers can be used to kind of track your management and your improvement in the situation. Some of the people that I've had that are hardest to control had enormous titers upon presentation, and I was able to see during my immunosuppressive therapy those titers track downward. So that's the utility in ELISA. Truthfully, the patients present dramatically different as well. As you know, pemphigus foliaceus doesn't generally involve the mucosa, the oral mucosa at all, whereas pemphigus vulgaris is completely opposite. Sometimes those patients, if you really query them and ask them, you know, how did this all start? They say, gosh, you know, several months ago I found I couldn't eat tortilla chips anymore. I found I couldn't eat cereal. My mouth was all torn up when I did things like that. So pemphigus vulgaris, just the opposite, often begins in the oral mucosa. And that has to do with how the desmogleins are expressed in the skin versus the mucosa.
Absolutely. And just to touch briefly on these immunobullous conditions that can affect the mucosa predominantly, I think of the paraneoplastic conditions, either paraneoplastic pemphigus, often with a recalcitrant course, cicatricial pemphigoid, which can also be paraneoplastic. Which laboratory techniques do you find most helpful in teasing out these mucosa predominant conditions?
Sure, that's a great disease. So again, in today's day and age, we rarely get any clinical information at all. Most of my pathology accession forms say something like rule out lesion or rule out nub or rule out. Don't get a lot of clinical information, but in the setting of immunobullous disease, it's very, very helpful to have as much clinical data as you can take time to provide because, like you said, the involvement in mucosa opens a completely different Pandora's box in pemphigus vulgaris as opposed to pemphigus foliaceus where you should really have sparing of the mucosa. So that's really important, is to convey enough clinical information to your dermatopathologist or the person examining your direct immunofluorescence such that they can really have the benefit of knowing what the patient probably looks like. But then, as you mentioned, when you're dealing with a mucosal disease, the main considerations are you know, bullous pemphigoid can involve the mouth. Cicatricial pemphigoid or mucous membrane pemphigoid is probably also within our differential diagnosis anytime the mucosa of the mouth or the eyes are involved. In fact, many of our cases come from the ophthalmologist. So those are important considerations. And then, as you mentioned, other things like bullous lupus, all those things become more of an issue. But really, the principal things that I'm always worried about when I see mucosal involvement are bullous pemphigoid of the mouth, cicatricial pemphigoid, and pemphigus vulgaris. And obviously, direct human fluorescence is going to be dramatically different in those. The two of them are linear deposition at the dermal epidermal juncture. One of them is net-like deposition in the epidermis. So that's important. But the other things you can do is you can think of what would the antibody profile look like. You had mentioned paraneoplastic pemphigus, which is a pretty rare esoteric diagnosis associated with non-Hodgkin's lymphomas in most cases, sometimes in children in Castleman's disease, things like that. But paraneoplastic pemphigus, one thing we do to at least get a clue that that's the diagnosis is we'll run the ELISA for bullous pemphigoid and we'll run the ELISA for pemphigus at the same time using the same patient's sera. If both tests are positive, the most likely explanation to have bullous pemphigoid antigens and pemphigus antibodies in the same blood is that the patient has paraneoplastic pemphigus. Now, obviously, we don't randomly assign somebody a diagnosis of paraneoplastic pemphigus unless it fits the clinical circumstances. But that's something you can do in 2 or 3 hours with your ELISA machine. And you can say, really, the only way to explain this dual positivity for bullous pemphigoid antibodies and pemphigus antibodies is if the patient does, in fact, have paraneoplastic pemphigus. And we do that more often than, I'm sure you remember, the routine screening method used to be rat bladder. Well, rat bladder doesn't have 100% sensitivity, and it's harder to do technically for us. So we'll just run both ELISA studies at the same time. And if both are positive and the clinical situation is compelling for paraneoplastic pemphigus, then we usually assume that that's our answer.
Great. That's very helpful. And then, you know, we always talk about using monkey esophagus on salt split skin for some of these conditions. When does that come into play?
Yeah, we've been doing less and less of that. Of course, there is guinea pig and monkey esophagus as substrates to screen for things like pemphigus foliaceus and pemphigus vulgaris. But we do less and less of that because the monkeys aren't willing donors in most of that. And so we do less and less of that and more ELISA, really. ELISA is a cheap, easy way to screen. And I'm not sure that it has tremendously less sensitivity than does any of those techniques. In fact, there was a very elegant study a few years ago from Germany and Spain, maybe it was Germany and Italy, where they actually looked at a combination of serologic tests, meaning indirect immunofluorescence, ELISA screening, and screening on substrates like monkey esophagus and guinea pig. And they actually found that if you did all those tests together, your sensitivity came up very, very near the sensitivity of direct immunofluorescence, but still direct immunofluorescence was slightly more sensitive. Now, does direct immunofluorescence catch all bullous pemphigoid? No, I can remember very clearly a case not that long ago where I really thought from H&E and from the clinical data that the patient had to have bullous pemphigoid, yet my direct immunofluorescence study was negative. And so it's important to remember that the sensitivity for direct immunofluorescence is around 90%, depends which study you prefer to quote. But in this case, I did go ahead and proceed with the serologic testing because I really thought the diagnosis was bullous pemphigoid. And those tests helped me catch this case, which for whatever reason was direct immunofluorescence negative. So that's important to remember is that that there's an art and a science of medicine. If it was just a cookbook thing, then everyone would be dermatologists. But it's appreciating that, gosh, these tests aren't 100% sensitive. And so I'm going to want to use them artistically to get to my final diagnosis, if that makes any sense.
Definitely. That's very important. And on that topic, you've mentioned the ELISA a lot for pemphigus and pemphigoid. But bullous lupus, obviously, we like to also check an anti-nuclear antibody. What about the sensitivity of an ELISA versus like an indirect fluorescent antibody testing? Because at this point, we know that almost all lupus should have ANA positivity. It's very, very rare to have a case of ANA negative.
Yeah, the ANA negative lupus is all pretty much gone away. Yeah.
So is it important to have your lab do the indirect fluorescent antibody, or is the ELISA sensitive enough?
I would always like to see, personally, an ANA ENA. That would be very, very preferred for me. Now, in truth, sometimes we're looking at a direct immunofluorescence specimen or even an indirect fluorescent specimen, and we will actually see an ANA positive result in the tissue. So that's very interesting. Sometimes we'll actually look in the keratinocytes along the epidermis and we'll actually see a positive ANA within the keratinocytes. And so we already know that the patient is probably positive. Now, also, we occasionally get lupus band questions. Sometimes people want to know, does this patient have a lupus band? Lupus band is really not as sensitive or specific as an ANA. Now, there was a time where there was real interest in lupus band because we didn't have these really exquisitely sensitive and specific ANA tests. But really, as you mentioned, ANA negative lupus has gone away. So, and that's because the test improved. And so lupus band is not really a test that I would prefer an ANA ENA over lupus band in most situations. Now, does it have utility or does it augment the diagnosis, or can you use it when you really suspect the diagnosis and something else has gone wrong, as I mentioned with the direct immunofluorescence for bullous pemphigoid? Sure. But I think an ANA ENA would be pretty important in those situations.
Fantastic. Is there anything that we're leaving out that you'd like to cover?
No, I think that's a pretty good review of the subject and a good review of laboratory tests. Did we talk about salt split skin at all? I'm not sure we formally talked about that, but salt split skin is a technique that you would use to kind of, as I mentioned, one thing you always want to be aware of, and especially if you're using mid-level providers or anything, is consistent with bullous pemphigoid, and we mentioned this, is different than a final diagnosis with clinical pathologic correlation of bullous pemphigoid. So if you have a situation where it's consistent with bullous pemphigoid, but you still wonder, is this cicatricial pemphigoid, mucous membrane pemphigoid, or is this EBA, epidermolysis bullosa acquisita, or bullous lupus erythematosus, that is a situation where the taking it to the next level may involve indirect immunofluorescence, taking the patient's sera, and then performing salt split skin. And in salt split skin, we take normal skin and we split it with 1 molar sodium chloride so that we know that it splits between the epidermis and dermis, and then we're able to repeat our indirect immunofluorescence studies, and we're able to see if the immunoreactants are depositing on the roof, like they would in bullous pemphigoid, or the floor, like they would in most forms, not all, most forms of cicatricial pemphigoid or bullous lupus or epidermolysis bullosa. So sometimes you're going to move from a direct immunofluorescence test that is, and the clinical situation is inconsistent with bullous pemphigoid, to an indirect immunofluorescence on salt split skin to try to refine where is the pattern of deposition. That's something that comes up a substantial amount of time.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Dr. High, for this enlightening conversation on immunobullous conditions.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
The autoantibodies associated with immunobullous diseases, either directly through steric hindrance or indirectly through recruitment of inflammatory cell and activation of complement, cause disruption of keratinocyte to keratinocyte or keratinocyte to matrix adhesion, resulting in clinical findings of erosions, vesicles, and bulla. Standard hematoxylin and eosin or H&E stains can be suggestive but often not diagnostic of these group of diseases. There are several tests used either alone or concurrently for the diagnosis of immunobullous diseases. Most commonly, these tests include direct immunofluorescence, indirect immunofluorescence, salt split skin, and enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay. Direct immunofluorescence detects in vivo antibodies bound to tissue antigens in the skin. Indirect immunofluorescence detects circulating serum antibodies on often non-human substrates that express high quantities of the antigenic target. For example, monkey esophagus for pemphigus vulgaris, or guinea pig esophagus for pemphigus foliaceus, and transitional rat bladder for paraneoplastic pemphigus. In indirect immunofluorescence, the substrate is incubated with serially diluted serum from the patient, followed by incubation with anti-human IgG or other fluorescent-tagged antibodies. Salt split skin is a variant of indirect immunofluorescence that allows the distinction between subepidermal blistering conditions with similar H&E and direct immunofluorescent findings. In salt split skin, normal human skin is incubated in 1 molar sodium chloride for 48 to 72 hours, causing a split in the lamina lucida, allowing the visualization of the autoantibodies either on the epidermal or dermal side. ELISA is a technique used for the detection of circulating antibodies in serum and can be used to monitor disease activity. Bullous pemphigoid is the most common immunobullous disease. Sensitivity and specificity of diagnostic tests have been characterized in bullous pemphigoid. These findings perhaps can be extrapolated to other immunobullous diseases. According to a 2013 single-center retrospective study of 313 patients by Sardi, direct immunofluorescence was found to be the most sensitive test, 90.8%, for the diagnosis of bullous pemphigoid. while ELISA had the lowest sensitivity of 72% for bullous pemphigoid 180 and 59% for bullous pemphigoid 230. Additionally, ELISA alone is insufficient for the diagnosis of bullous pemphigoid. In a 2010 study of 337 patients, Whelan found 7% of subjects without any clinical signs of bullous pemphigoid were still seropositive on ELISA. Whelan et al. Found 7% of subjects without any clinical signs of bullous pemphigoid were still seropositive on ELISA. In clinical practice, direct immunofluorescence is unarguably an essential tool for the diagnosis of immunobullous diseases. To increase the specificity of direct immunofluorescence, the tissue should be taken from perilesional skin. Lesional samples can often yield false positive results. However, Vodigal et al. Found that the sensitivity is higher for samples transported and stored in normal saline, rather than Michel's solution, if processed within 24 hours. On the other hand, contact with formalin can decrease the sensitivity of direct immunofluorescence. Interestingly, it has been reported that this decrease in sensitivity varied by the disease. Pemphigus samples were particularly sensitive even to short exposure to formalin, whereas samples of dermatitis herpetiformis and bullous pemphigoid retained immunogenicity even after 10 minutes in formalin. Remarkably, in a 1980 publication in the Journal of Clinical Pathology, researchers were able to perform direct immunofluorescence on skin biopsy specimens that were fixed in formalin and embedded in paraffin wax. The study concluded that despite the decreased signal intensity and a higher rate of negatives, diagnosis of most cases of pemphigus, pemphigoid, and lupus erythematosus were still possible from paraffin blocks.